Hi, I'm Umushu.
And I'm Lindsay Claiborne, and you're listening to Beyond the Microscope.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Beyond the Microscope. Today's guest is Tara Shears. She is a particle physicist and professor of physics at the University of Liverpool, and she also conducts research experiments at CERN, so she'll talk to us a little bit more about that. Tara, thanks so much for being on the show.
No problem, I'm delighted to be here.
I guess we'll start off with a very basic question of what is it that you do?
Of course, that's always the most complicated question to answer. So what I do is research particle physics. And by particle physics, what that means is we're trying to work out what stuff is made of. So what you're made of, what your recording equipment is made of, what the Earth and stars are made of. And we come to it through the idea that everything is made of the same types of very tiny ingredients that we call fundamental particles. And our science is all to do with trying to work out what those tiny fundamental particles are and how they behave. And we've tried to put our description of what we think happens into a theory that describes what goes on at the very smallest scales of the universe. And our experiments that we carry out at CERN and elsewhere are really to try and test this theory and find its limits, because there are some really big questions out there, some real mysteries in the universe that we don't understand at all and we can't explain in our theory. So we know there's got to be something else out there, and that's driving us on to build these enormous experiments, take enormous amounts of data, and then to sift through everything that we've collected and see if we can find any answers.
How did you wind up in this field in the first place? It seems sort of, I mean, obviously it's a progressive field and it's where a lot of discoveries can be made, but what made you think that this is what you wanted to study?
Do you know, I didn't know that I wanted to do this until quite late on. I always liked physics when I was at school, and I liked a lot of other things as well, but what I liked about physics was that it explained things quite simply, and you could break down problems so that they turned out to be a lot more simple than you originally thought, and that could help you work it out, and that was really nice. So I studied physics as an undergraduate, and it was when I was in my final year, actually, that I had a course in particle physics, and I really liked it. I was so interested in it. It seemed to be such a nice way of trying to understand the universe. And I think it's just then, at that point, that I decided that I wanted to do it for a bit longer. I wanted to find out a bit more about it. So I did a PhD in it, and then I never really stopped after that.
And is it as nice of a way as you thought it would be?
It is, actually. What I really like about it is that most questions you can ask are really quite complicated. I mean, if I ask you what you're made of, or if I ask you why something happens, you know, it's quite difficult to very unambiguously say an answer. But in particle physics, we just have one question, which is, what are things made of? And we try and approach it in the simplest way we can by going down to the very smallest ingredients where life gets less complicated. And so we're really enormous cheats. We just make life as easy for ourselves as possible when it comes to answering questions. And when you can answer questions, that's a really nice feeling. So I think that's why we do it.
So we can see molecules and we can see atoms using a microscope, let's say, right? I think.
That's right.
It's been a while since I've taken these courses. How does one see these tinier components, these quarks and all these other things that we've talked about before?
It's really indirect. So to give you a sort of sense of scale, if you go down in size from you to one of your atoms, to go down in size to one of your fundamental particles, you have to do that same shrink all over again. And we can only just see atoms, so there's no way on Earth you can see a fundamental particle. It's just too small. But what we can do is, in our experiments, we can detect the presence of these very tiny particles. If they're very energetic, we can detect the fact that they've move through detector material, we find a signal for them. And what we end up doing in our experiments, where we crash beams of particles together to make fundamental particles, is we end up with a sort of an archaeology puzzle. We have all these traces that we see in our experiments, and we spend our time trying to work out which types of fundamental particles gave rise to which other types of tracks and deposits and what have you. And when we visualize this, because we can't see it directly, we visualize it in terms of what our detector responds to. So quite often in particle physics, you'll see these cartoon-like things called an event display, which is what we say is, it's a snapshot of fundamental particles being produced or doing something. And to us, that is a snapshot. That's the picture we have for these things. We see a picture of them in action as they're produced and then they do something. But it's an interpretation of the data. It's really impossible to see these things directly because they're far, far too small. And we don't have any sort of magnifiers or microscopes which are good enough to let us see it directly. Does that make sense?
Well, here's a follow-up to that. Technology and microscopes and lenses and capabilities and whatnot have changed so much over the past 50 years, let alone the past 5 years. Does that change what you do and how you do your work, or how you sort of prove what you're trying to prove?
In a sense, because our particle accelerators are really the sort of like the far end of a microscope, if you like, because they really do behave like a microscope. So even though you tend to think of a microscope as a sort of like an apparatus you have in front of you that you can sort of slides into, and you can alter the focus, and then you can sort of like see pond life or something, you can actually make different versions that where you probe things not with light but with beams of particles instead. And this gives you a different way of seeing something, a different way of being sensitive to an object, but it allows you to see it with more precision. So if you like, our particle accelerators are like a different type of microscope that's right at the cutting edge of the technology of that type of thing. That's one answer to your question. Another answer actually is it goes into the technicalities of how you build an accelerator. What happens is we have beams of particles going around, and these beams are kept in order and put round their path by big magnets to bend them round or to focus them into tiny points. And that sort of technology, where you have to focus things, that's really concerns us, because that affects the energies of our experiments, and that in turn affects how much we can tell about the universe in a very fundamental sense from them.
What are the bigger surprises you have when you're working with these kind of things? Do you sort of know what you're expecting when you go into an experiment or whatever you're doing? Or are you sort of, you push the button and see what happens? I mean, what kind of level of, I mean, that would be great, wouldn't it? But, you know, what level of sort of, are you just proving the argument you already have? Or do you say, let's see what happens when we do this?
It's a bit of both. So when you build and design an experiment, it's usually with a particular question in mind that you're trying to find the answer to. Now, we do have a theory of particle physics, and that tells us a lot about what we might expect to see if we build an experiment. So if we want to explore that, that's great. We know we should be able to see that and get our results. But there's all these other questions out there that we're trying to find answers to. Questions like, what's dark matter? What's this mysterious stuff made of? What's antimatter? And why don't you have more of it in the universe? And things you might think are a bit weird to think about, but they happen to be a really big deal for us. So we might design experiments to try and explore those questions where we're not confident at all about even finding answers, because we don't know what the answer is. We just build it and look at the data and see what there is. So even though there's one set of things that we know we're going to see according to our existing theory that we can then test, what we're really hoping for is the other stuff that you mentioned, the let's see what's out there type of stuff. I mean, that's the stuff we're always interested in suddenly uncovering inside our experiments, because that's the really exciting stuff.
So what's the time frame for an experiment? So let's say you come up with a question that you want to test, and then from that, how long does it take to set up? How long is an actual experiment, and then how long does it take to analyze the data that comes out?
Oh gosh, far too long. It's awful. So to give you an example, I work at an experiment on CERN's Large Hadron Collider. Now that accelerator, I think, first was proposed and put forward back in the 1980s, and it took from the 1980s till 2008 to develop the technology to be able to build it, and then to build it, and then install it, and then build the experiments that go on it. And then the LHC started up momentarily in 2008, really got going in 2010. It's got a program that should keep going to about 2030 or even beyond that. And it takes time to analyze this data. So, you know, you're looking at people who can have careers in one experiment. It doesn't give you a lot of sort of variety.
That seems actually more stressful. Because what if one part of it doesn't work and you've spent 20 years getting to that one point? That seems terrible. That seems terrible. I'm sorry.
that seems terrible to me too. I'm glad it hasn't happened.
Speaking of what you're working on, what's your daily job like? I mean, is it obviously when you're working on different parts of the experiment, but if they can take months or years to get ready, what are you doing on a daily basis when you come into the office?
Well, actually, you hardly ever go down to see your experiment. It's underground. It's 100 meters under the ground. And when you're taking data, it's sealed off completely because there's a radiation risk if you were to go down there when the beams are circulating. So, you know, it's quite a remote thing. We pipe the data out of the experiment, we put it on computers all over the world, and then we sit in our offices all over the world analyzing what we see and then having video conference meetings over the internet where we can discuss it with each other. So I guess a typical day is being in your office, wherever your office happens to be, and for me that's either in Liverpool or it might be out here at CERN, and it's putting your jobs in, getting your code working, looking at the data, getting really excited because you think you've discovered something in the data, and then about half an hour later realizing it's a bug in your code.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes, it never stops.
Yeah, I have one more question about CERN, and this is from a media perspective. I mean, there's all this talk, probably unfounded, maybe, about public perception and about the Hadron Collider and why we started it and why we stopped it and all these sort of feelings about it. Does that even play into what you're working on? Or you're like, this is a machine that I can use to learn things and I don't care what anybody else thinks?
Well, for us, that's it. That's why we're doing particle physics. It's to use what comes out of this machine. That's why we're all involved in it, and that's why we come to CERN. Although we are quite interested in the way that other people perceive CERN and what we're doing. And it's really nice that it seems to be so popular, at least to me it seems popular, and so many people want to know about it, which is great, because it's nice to just try and explain it and to tell people what you do. And it's something that I've noticed has really changed since the LHC started, actually. When I was working in particle physics before then, you could tell people what you did, and they usually weren't very interested. And the minute you said physics, that was it. They were at the door, running away from you. But something happened when the LHC turned on. And I know there was a lot of publicity about, is it going to make a black hole? Is it going to destroy the Earth? Is it going to do something even worse? And somebody took out a lawsuit to try and stop CERN turning on. And there was, you know, it was great from the reporting perspective because there were so many crazy stories coming out.
Right.
But at that point, people had heard of CERN. And then people had heard of what we were doing. And then people wanted to know, you know, well, why are you doing this? You know, why would you do this? What's it for? And we're interested in the answers, and we think it's fascinating because we do it. So at that point, actually, it became a lot easier to talk to people about it. Suddenly, if you told people what you did, they wanted to talk to you and they bought you drinks. It was wonderful.
Hear that, kids? If you go into particle physics, people will buy you drinks. Actually, I wanted to come back a little bit. You mentioned that when the LHC first started, you would get these crazies I shouldn't say crazies. You would get folks who are very concerned about a black hole starting, right? So how do you respond to someone who has that mentality?
Well, we took it really seriously because the reason this came up was because theorists had made a prediction that it could happen at the LHC. So when there's a danger of something happening that you don't want, you do a risk assessment to see if it's actually going to happen. And that's actually what CERN did. They carried out a risk assessment that we would make black holes. And they got theorists from all over the world to perform this risk assessment and to write this document. And this document concluded that if you could make black holes with the LHC, then you would have made black holes many, many bazillions of times over in the natural processes that go on inside sort of the Earth and the solar system. And it hasn't happened. So they're either not there or they're too small to make a difference. And either way, it's not a problem. And that was the basis of the risk assessment. And so, but having that is good because it lets you talk about science and the scientific method. Because in science, we have facts and we also have hypotheses and theories. And it's usually the hypotheses and theories that can lead you to a greater understanding if they make a prediction that you can then find out and prove. If you have data, then you just know what you have and you can describe what you have. And having this prediction about black hole production and being able to try and say why it wouldn't happen, I thought that was a really nice way to, in a sort of strange nutshell, to try and describe how our daily work goes. We have an idea, we have a prediction that something might happen, then we work out whether it actually will happen or not. And in that case, luckily, it doesn't, which is why, we're okay, we're still here, and the LHC is still going.
What's the most fun about your job? Just from your descriptions, it's obvious that you love what you do, but what part of it gets you excited? Is it all of it? Is there a particular element?
It's definitely not all of it. Debugging computer code. Oh, that's the limit. There's one thing which always gets you, and that's when you look at data and you try and understand what you see. And there's something there that you don't understand that's compelling and interesting. It's a problem. It's a problem to solve. And it's got the hint at the end of it that if it really is something new, then you have discovered something new. You've done something important. You've really helped people understand more about the universe. That's why we do it. And no matter how often we look at data, how often we see these hints that then disappear because they're just fluctuations, it's just those moments when you realize that the first time you're seeing something that nobody else has, and that this thing might be the thing that makes the difference and that could really lead us on in our understanding. It's those moments that really, really make it a compelling thing to do and make you work, well, sometimes crazy hours and pull all-nighters just because you want to know the answer. So it's those moments, I think, that make it always a fun and interesting thing to do.
So what are the big, exciting questions that you want to be able to answer in the next, say, 5-10 years?
Right, so there's a few of them. We've got a shopping list. And the really big questions are, what's dark matter? What's this mysterious, invisible, extra stuff that seems to be in galaxies that hold stars in their orbits? It should be something we should understand because it should be stuff, it should be matter, and it's our business to understand matter. So we'd really like to know that one, and that would let us understand more of the universe. We'd also like to understand what makes antimatter slightly different to normal matter. So antimatter is like normal matter, except it has the opposite charge. And it's very important to understand the evolution of the universe, but we really don't understand much about it. So if we want to understand how the universe got here, basically we have to understand that. So that's another big one. And then there's a whole host of other questions which are just as pressing and which sound even weirder. Like, does the universe have more dimensions than the four we know about? How can we understand gravity? Because, this makes us sound so stupid, because you know what gravity is. I mean, everybody probably knows what gravity is. They know it's the thing that sticks them to the Earth. That's why no one floats off into space. You know, gravity's there. Everybody knows about it on a daily basis. But when you get down to the very tiny distance scales that we probe in particle physics, we've got absolutely no idea how to understand gravity there. None of our approaches make any sense. We can't use our normal theories, and any other theories that we come up with just don't fit our data. So that's something that's also quite obvious that we'd really like to understand too. So I can list more and more and more really, really pressing questions that we're actively searching for answers to. And the LHC is a really big experiment. There are four experiments there. There must be about 10,000 particle physicists all working on there, each one with their personal list of priorities. So even though there's loads of us and fewer questions than there are physicists, we're going to do our best to try and see what's out there.
How many people does it take for one experiment, or can people use the same experiment to analyze different types of data? I mean, how much crossover is there, or do you have to be like, we are doing experiment A and only, physicist A and B can use it? I mean, how much crossover is there?
There's total crossover. So if you're a member of an experiment, then there might be hundreds of you or even thousands of you, but you all have access to absolutely all the data that's collected by that experiment. It's open to everybody, so everybody can analyze whatever they want.
Well, that seems like you guys all have to get along.
Yes, and it's actually pretty amazing how that happens. If you think there are experiments here at CERN that have 3,000 people working on them, and these are 3,000 people worldwide, so there are people in America and Canada and Japan and China, every corner of the world you can come to. And each of these people is working as a volunteer. Hardly anybody is paid to work on these experiments. People do it in their research time when they have other jobs in institutes. So if they're lecturers or they're researchers, they do their research on this experiment. And You would think that would make it really difficult to tell people what to do. You know, you're not paying them. Why should they listen to you? And the thing that makes it work, or the thing that seems to make it work, is that everybody wants to get to the same answers. Everybody wants to know the answers to the same questions. And everybody knows there is no way that they could get there by themselves. They rely on other people to run the experiments, to understand different aspects of the experiment. You know, it genuinely takes an experiment of thousands to produce the results that these experiments end up coming out with. And I think it's that mixture of need and shared goal that makes it work so successfully.
Is there a project, I mean, I don't know about the sort of feasibility of stuff like that, but if you didn't have any budgetary limitations or having to share with anybody, is there some topic or subject or question that you would focus on or that you would want to learn about?
Yes.
When you take money out of the equation.
Yes.
Yes, I was just thinking that would be wonderful. I would build the world's biggest particle accelerator. It would go round the Earth. It would be the biggest one ever. It would be the most powerful one ever. And that would be the thing that would let me probe the universe with the best magnification yet and give me the best chance of making discoveries. Yeah, I bet you every particle physicist you give that offer to, they're going to ask for that.
So is there some... You know, is discovery, is the limitation money then? Or is it still something technological that we haven't been able to sort of quite achieve yet?
I think the limitation, what it comes down to is our ignorance about the universe. Because we don't know where we're going to find the discoveries that are going to tell us the answers. And that means that every experiment we build essentially goes out into the unknown. And we look at unknown facets of the universe in the hope of finding any hints as to where we're going to make the discovery that's going to tell us more about the universe. And yes, technology does limit us because you can only accelerate particles to certain energies using existing technologies, and that affects the range of your experiment. And cost certainly is an issue because, you know, we join together from around the world to make these experiments work, but they're expensive, and not everybody wants to spend money on particle physics experiments. There are many other important things to spend money on too. But because of our ignorance, we don't know really where to put our experiments, were they to be within the range of our technology, where we would find answers. And that's because I know this sounds a bit disappointing, but that's because it's really blue skies research and we really are going out into the unknown and we really are surveying parts of the universe that have never been mapped before. It's like being an explorer going to a new country. You know, you land there, which is wonderful, but then you've got the business of trying to understand where you are in it and where else there is in that country. And that's what it's like for us. Every time we start a new experiment, you know, that it might be in that country that you've landed in, there might be a wonderful city hundreds of miles inland. And that's something that in our experiments we would find after sort of maybe 10, 20 years of analyzing data. There might not be anything at all. You might just have ended up on like a dead island and you might have to sail on again to make a discovery. And that's really how it is for us. When we have access to a piece of the universe that we haven't studied before with an experiment, we can't tell before we start if it's going to give us the breakthroughs that we're looking for. But all we do know is because we're going somewhere new, we've got far more chance of making a breakthrough than we have if we stay where we are. That's really how it works.
Well, is there anything that, how, if somebody didn't know anything about particle physics, how would you describe it if I can dare to say this, in a tweet or something like that? Like, what would you, I know, it's a terrible thing to ask you to do, but like, how would you describe it in its sort of, in a succinct sort of way that captures all of the sort of elements of it? And is it just like, well, we look at things that are small?
Well, thank you. Right now? Oh, goodness.
That's a tough question.
I hate that question, and I'm sorry I asked it.
No, it's a really good question. It's trying to put it into words. It's the most fundamental scientific exploration that you can get. If you really want to understand anything, if you really want to understand it at a very deep level, you have to know what it's made of, how those bits fit together, how it's all functioning. And this applies whether we're trying to understand a glass, a cup of tea, or the entire universe. It's the same process. We're in the business of trying to understand the universe, but we're trying to do it from the smallest levels upwards. That's the direction that you've taken. That's what particle physics is.
That was pretty good.
That was really good. I want to back up and clarify a little bit, because you had mentioned antimatter and dark energy. As someone who was never really great at particle physics or quantum physics, can you sort of explain to like what antimatter is and what dark energy is?
Sure. So every type of fundamental particle that we know about, like an electron, like a quark, has an antimatter equivalent type of particle. And if you have an electron and its antimatter version, they're almost impossible to tell apart, except they have the opposite electric charge to each other. So that's how we recognize it. And also, a very good diagnostic of when you have antimatter is when you have antimatter meeting matter, it just annihilates. And it releases all of its energy in a gigantic explosion. So a quarter of a gram of antimatter meeting a quarter of a gram of normal matter has the explosive force of 5 kilotons of TNT. That's fine, but you don't see that around you. We don't see antimatter explosions. And that's the mysterious thing for us. Because when the universe started in the Big Bang, we think at that point, half the universe was made of matter and half of it was made of antimatter. And all the fundamental particles that were produced in the very early stages of the universe, both the matter ones and the antimatter ones, were busy annihilating with each other. And these annihilations produced more pairs of matter and antimatter particles. And this whole process of annihilation was going on as the universe was expanding. But here's the thing. By the time the universe was about, less than a second old, it had expanded and cooled so much that this process had to stop. And when it stopped, there was very slightly more matter than antimatter. So that the outcome of those last annihilations was that you just had some matter left in the universe. And that tiny bit that was left over, those leftovers, that's what we're made of now. We're made of the last parts of those last annihilations. So we wouldn't be here unless there was something strange about antimatter to make it shrink a little bit in relation to the normal matter at that point. And that's what we want to understand. You might think it's a tiny point, but it explains how we got here after the Big Bang. It's one of the most important things that we need to understand to explain how we got here from the Big Bang. And we have absolutely no clue, if I'm honest, about why this is. And so it's an active area of our research to measure matter, to measure antimatter, and just try and measure the differences and see if they give us clues. So that's why antimatter is so important for us. So dark energy is a completely different thing. So the universe is expanding, and what is driving the expansion is this mysterious thing that we call dark energy. It's a sort of force that is driving the expansion out. We don't know what it is. We haven't predicted it. It's just what people have inferred from looking at how the universe is behaving. And I've got to say, that is a complete and utter mystery to me. I don't even have any hypotheses of what it might be that would then lead to predictions that I can test. But most of the universe is in the form of dark energy, apparently, according to cosmologists, which makes it a pretty important deal to understand.
That is... the dark energy to me is just... It's just mind-blowing. I can't wrap my head around it.
Yeah, actually, me neither.
No, I'm good. I mean, is there anything that we didn't address that you think might be important to know about or is under the radar that people don't know about?
Actually, one thing that people might not realize about working in particle physics is that it's a really international thing to do. It's probably the last thing that would occur to you because you would think, particle physics, fundamental physics, small stuff, etc. But one of the really brilliant things I have discovered about doing particle physics and working somewhere like CERN or Fermilab in America, which is also where I've worked in the past, is that because these are really global experiments, you get people coming from all over the world to work together. And that's just a wonderful thing. You can go into the cafeteria, you hear so many different languages, and you're not a languages expert, so you don't understand anything apart from the words that are in common to all the languages. And words like Higgs boson and Large Hadron Collider. Those are the words that come up again and again and again and again. It's really fascinating. And it's really, really nice to have this international environment. It's a real privilege. So when you think of particle physics, and if you're ever interested in studying physics or having a trip to Geneva, if you ever get the chance, because it's free to visit, then this international nature, it's really an international organization. I think it's something that you only realize then, but it's a really brilliant thing.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Tara, for enlightening us about the world of particle physics.
Like our show, find out more at scopepodcast.com and follow us online on Facebook and Twitter at Scope Podcast. This is Lindsay Claiborne
and Mumu Shu.
Our theme music was composed by The Copycuts. Thanks for listening.